quick heads up before we start. I'll be hosting a webinar on using AI to boost your LinkedIn profile. The best part? The webinar is free. If you want to know how to take your LinkedIn profile into all-star status, getting the attention that you want, pivoting careers, telling the story that you want to be told, join me at this webinar where I'm going to be showing you three killer strategies to make your professional presence pop. You can find the registration link in the show notes. And don't forget to follow me on LinkedIn, connect with me there if you would like, and my other social media platforms. And I've got a newsletter now, so be sure to sign up for the newsletter to not miss out on any offerings at yumiwilson.me. Now, let's get going. Welcome to AI in Journalism. I'm Yumi Wilson, a journalism professor, branding expert, and your host. In this podcast, we'll boldly explore the intersection of AI and journalism, from its origins to its implications for newsrooms. We'll discuss the symbiosis of AI and human judgment, ethical concerns, and most importantly, arm you with the knowledge to navigate this brave new world. Whether you're a budding journalist, seasoned editor, or simply an AI enthusiast, join us as we fearlessly uncover the future of journalism in the age of artificial intelligence. Welcome to AI in Journalism. Welcome to AI in Journalism, your go-to podcast for diving into the world of artificial intelligence in the media. I'm your host, Yumi Wilson, and in today's episode, we dive into a contentious issue at the intersection of AI and journalism. The recent uproar involving Perplexity AI and Forbes isn't just about legal skirmishes over content use. It challenges us to question the very nature of journalism in the AI era. Are we approaching a future where the essence of journalistic work is reduced to mere fodder for algorithms? Are paywalls and intellectual property rights enough to protect the integrity of journalistic labor? Or are we on the brink of fundamentally transforming what it means to be a journalist? To help us unpack these critical questions, Subramaniam Subbu Vincent, Director of Journalism and Media Ethics at the Markkula Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University, leading innovative projects to combat disinformation and enhance media integrity. A John S. Knight Journalism Fellow and a Distinguished Service to Journalism awardee, he's also a noted voice on LinkedIn's top journalism influencers. Subbu, welcome to AI in Journalism.
Thank you, Yumi. It's great to be with you, and I look forward to this chat.
And before we get started, as always, my little plug for the listeners. If you are just joining us for the first time, please, please, please hit that subscribe button or follow me on LinkedIn or both. And so we can build an audience and a community who are talking about AI in journalism and the media. So this summer, Subbu, you wrote about the ethical and legal disputes between AI companies and content publishers, but nothing quite like Forbes' recent accusation about Perplexity AI. This is a unique moment in 2024 because the spat is about journalistic labor and form. What's missing in all the back and forth about the adequacy or not of citations, traffic referrals, and rights is a discussion on a fundamental question. What is the future of the journalistic form? Paywalled or not, are we headed to a future where journalists are merely laboring to supply tokens, pun intended, to large language models and their applications? What are your thoughts on that?
So it's the pun that really got me to jump out as I was trying to write this piece, that literally large language models are built with training data, text, and images that are called tokens. You take a word and you split it up into tokens. And all of journalism that is appearing on answer engines today, especially, for example, Perplexity AI, which is a startup trying to fight their way into Google's dominance in the space, for example, all of the way journalistic work is appearing in the so-called knowledge summaries that are being created is in the form of these citations, logos of the publishers are included. And I was like, is that it? Are we tokenizing journalism literally? Because the use of power, the power to bring in people in the name of knowledge, and rightfully so, it's not like they're not distributing useful information. They are. You can't take that away from these answer engines. But the power of how to get users in the millions is with the technology-based companies. And when you have the power to bring all of those people, journalism has been kind of tokenized to be the fact contributors or the claim contributors or little bits of information across multiple publishers' articles. And I felt like, what's ever going to happen to all the people who did the work and who wrote the articles and whose articles have a certain graphical interface to them that have images, that have videos, that have methodology updates, that have some explanations of sourcing? None of that will be accessible to these users who are humans like you and me unless they click and go through. But the click interest is already going down the more information you put up front. There's a whole politics of clicking itself on whether clicking was even monetizable because of how ad tech got monopolized between the two big tech firms. That itself is an issue. There's an antitrust case going on. So even without all the answer engine summarization, clicking through was already not that monetizable, especially for boots on the ground, intensive, labor-intensive journalism, which really needs form to stand as an intervention into democracy and discourse. So that's why I felt this is tokenization, literally technological tokenization, and formative, you know, diminishing kind of feeling that it has. So that's why the pun happened.
So I tried Perplexity AI and I typed in, tell me about the controversy about Forbes and Perplexity AI. And I got to tell you, Perplexity AI did a pretty good job of, you know, kind of factually just summarizing the points of what the argument is. Now, here was the other thing. I then asked, who do you think is right? And you know what Perplexity AI said?
I'm curious. Tell me. That's a really good question to ask because you're going at the meta model level, like who's right.
Exactly. Because, you know, I've been hearing more and more about this. They said Forbes.
What did they say Forbes was right about? Because there are multiple disputes here. The dispute that Forbes was absolutely valid in their complaint about was that, one, it was a paywall piece that they did the Eric Schmidt expose on the stealth drones project. Two, separate from the fact that it was actually paywalled or not, it was their scoop. And the way the language showed up in Perplexity's summary originally was kind of the way non-journalists summarized. They were basically giving citations as numbers, but not naming the publications in the text. Like when you are a human curator and you do when you're doing a derivative piece, it's expected in press ethics that the New York Times will cite the Wall Street Journal by name as the first publisher, despite all the power of language models. And by the way, these are language models underlying it. Language models understand journalistic language too. I'm not saying they understand as humans understand, but they have the training data patterns in them, if they want to call that out, in order to be able to name a publisher as the first publisher of something, even in their summary. All of that didn't actually happen, but also it didn't happen because there was no policy in Perplexity to intend it to happen, and they changed that. On that page, Perplexity managed to add the Forbes name in the text as well. So yeah, so that I think they acknowledged that Forbes was valid in making the issue out. But I think there's multiple disputes there and not just that.
In fact, I just pulled it up. And, you know, one of the great things about many of these interfaces, you can save your chats. And I really actually enjoy archiving all of, you know, because it's like going back, it's like work you've already done anyway. So when I asked the question, what is the controversy? They had 7 points and they talked about plagiarism accusations, content reproduction, dissemination of content, legal threats, Perplexity's response, the CEO, Aravind Srinivas.
Srinivas.
Yeah. He acknowledged the incident. He said it was a new project feature with, quote, rough edges. And then it talked about broader implications. And then it wrote, the dispute between Forbes and Perplexity AI underscores the ongoing tension between AI companies and traditional media outlets, raising questions about the ethical use of content, proper attribution, and the future of journalism in an AI-dominated landscape. So this was all written by Perplexity. And then I wrote, is it true? And the first response they gave me was the stock prices for True Car. And then I asked a different question and they said, Based on the search results provided, it appears that the controversy between Forbes and Perplexity AI is indeed true. Here are the key points confirming the situation. Forbes sent a letter to Perplexity's AI CEO.
Yep.
Yeah. So the letter demands Perplexity remove the infringing content. The controversy stems from creating AI-generated videos, articles, and podcasts on Forbes' original reporting. Forbes claims that Perplexity's AI chatbot reproduced significant portions of the reporting without proper attribution. And yeah, so essentially it was confirming that what I first read was indeed accurate. And then I wrote, oh, no, are the allegations true? And they said, it appears that the allegations made by Forbes against Perplexity AI are indeed true.
Why did that surprise you? I would think that given the kind of technology they're using to retrieve pages and summarize, I'm not surprised. It would take an effort to actually hide the answer.
I am surprised because what I noticed on ChatGPT, I use a 4.0 and I've been using the newer model, but what I notice is, let's say that I ask a question that has graphic content or that is, you know, has to do with things that, let's say, the FCC wouldn't allow during daytime on network TV. They won't answer the questions. So clearly LLMs have been trained to, you know, say, we're not going to talk about these issues. You've come to the wrong place. And so I thought, since it involved Perplexity AI, they would also train and say, look, we don't want to talk about this issue. But they did.
Yeah. So my interest there is, if the case had actually been a litigated case, if it had gone to a court and the matter was in trial, then would the answer bot come back and say, this case is in court, therefore we cannot talk about it as a machine? But the case is not in court. It's basically at the level of a complaint that's gone from one attorney to another.
That was really the issue that I felt like I've already seen a number of, even Gemini will do this sometimes, where I'll ask something, you know, and it's like they've decided, well, we can't answer that, or we can't, you know, we can't generate a response for that. I'm like, oh, okay. And so I just thought Perplexity would do the same.
Yeah, I think yesterday there was an expose type article in Futurism about the Washington Post's AI answer bot. They have a custom tool, I think they've launched, that when used to query the AI assistant, when used to query Washington Post's own corpus on the impact of AI on climate change as a negative externality, on the amount of power, the sheer amount of power that data centers running LLM applications and LLMs are consuming compared to even Google search type applications. When asked about that, I think there was some reticence in the bot to initially come up with answers, but I'm just using reticence as a human behavior, but I think the analog doesn't transfer to machines. But I think later in the article, they do say that when they were very specific in how they were asking, more articles did show up from the Post's climate change reporting. Anyway, so yeah, I'm using Perplexity too, and I use other systems as well. I'm fascinated by the power of language models on language, on words and word patterns. I'm just not a big fan of the jump from language capacity to news and information capacity, because information itself is a judgment the human mind is making when encountered with a set of words, compared to the background knowledge you may have that set of words goes into. And then you conclude, this is new, I didn't know this, or this is different from what I was expecting. And then there's a kind of landscape thing happening in the mind. If you listen to Emily Blender, she reports, talks about it in more detail the way a computational linguist does. But basically, there's a difference between the set of words and patterns that language models are really, really better than all the previous generation of technologies to predict and to put outputs, to retrieve from other documents and all of that, to do all the fancy stuff we're seeing on answer bots. To go from that to useful information and knowledge, I think it's not as a fast a leap as the claims that are being made. Because there are claims being made that are pretty major claims, and I'm skeptical of the claims, but not of the capacities of these tools to do what they're doing, because I see that too.
So when you mentioned chatbots, it made me think of a guest I just interviewed, Melise Blanchard, who talked about chatbots and robots and this idea of, at some point, we are going to have friends in the form of AI that know us, that are going to kind of fill in, complete us. So what are your thoughts on that? It just seems like I am going to have a really good friend on AI who's going to know how I'm feeling today and then just ask, you know, Yumi, are you down today? Have you done your exercise?
So let me start with the word no, K-N-O-W, because I'm empathetic to the human nature to seek the human-like behavior behind the form that looks human-like. So if a machine puts out very conversational text that has your own kind of expression because it's trained on your own expression and it starts talking back to you as if the machine can know what you're about to say or what you've said and so what you might be feeling, etc., etc., that form has the ability to actually persuade you to think that the machine knows you. But the word no, if you go to psychologists and even philosophers and people who study epistemology and all of that, they will say, before you give the machine a mind, just start with the presumption that there is no mind in the machine. It's a mathematical system trained on distributions of words and patterns and pictures and so on. But it's so accurate in its training, in its prediction of what's, if it's trained only on you, I don't mean accuracy as in 100%. I'm just saying if it's trained on all the stuff you've said and done, it has a way to be able to actually predict what comes next in ways that were never actually seen before. So you feel like it knows you, but there is no human on the other side. We should use the word knows like one human knows another, where you feel empathetic, where you feel like you're walking in the other person's shoes, where you feel that you understand that person's journey, and therefore you feel like it's two kindred spirits who know each other. That's a human thing. I'm not sure we'll feel that, but I think what's happening is, and this is where I may part ways with some of my friends, is there is such a need for belonging and connectedness amongst humans in the digital era. That, and we're not getting enough of that from our own friends and family. Everybody's kind of more atomic in their lives than we were probably 100 years ago or 50 years ago. There were all kinds of problems then that we don't have now. We have better democracy now than earlier, even though we have a 2024 situation, a dire situation. So even though we have things now that we didn't have then, there is this search for in-person connectedness. And it looks like the shortcut to that are bots that may actually talk like they know us and may even be able to say things about us at a more predictable level than we ourselves because we have failing memories. We ourselves may not remember everything about the past at short notice, but they can if you kind of train them. So I'm mixed about that. I just feel like the words matter.
All right. Well, thank you for that because now there will be some balance for listeners. So you had mentioned that there is a concern about journalism or news and information becoming part of the, you know, the LLMs and then ultimately these interfaces of all kinds. But isn't journalism at its very basic purpose, foundation, information that should be shared and to inform the public, if you will? And so what would be the distinction that you make and what would be the concern that you have about journalism, about news articles, you know, of course, attribution included, but what would you have in terms of concerns about that? And why would you distinguish that from other information systems?
So I look at this from the democracy and democratic culture paradigm, because that's really where the central problems of modern society are. And I start from there because we can have a very different conversation if you're strictly talking about technology's power to distribute news, to distribute information aggregated in a way that makes it very useful as knowledge to update the knowledge of modern day professionals. If we strictly talk about capacity and markets and innovations that serve a need in a changing environment, we can have a really good conversation about how the AI LLM revolution is kind of the next step from the previous generation of news aggregator apps, about how Google Search was distributing the news. Smart News is an app, for example, and all of these apps, including social media, where there's now this thing about Meta saying we'll not do news, et cetera, et cetera. And even Google says we won't do news if they're asked to pay. My thing is, if you start with democracy, the job that journalists are doing, they're not doing just for information's own sake. That's the output of journalistic work. Yes. So, I mean, prima facie, people take information, people take stories, people take narratives, and representations and the way other people live their lives that's depicted in the stories and understand how fellow citizens around the world, around the city, are experiencing issues and how politicians react to that. Maybe new laws emerge. While that's all processed from the information level, it also matters who did the stories and why they are intervening the way they're intervening, because there's a real democracy at stake. And the intervening actors are not just politicians. They're not just judges. They're actually journalists on the ground who are doing the work. And they have agency. They have agency to speak to people, agency to do their sourcing, agency to include whose voices are central to a story and who's not. And they ought to be held to account. And that's what journalism ethics takes on as a way to say, why did you do all these pieces? Why did you source it this way? Can you explain that? While the accountability thing is not really done as often as it should be, and that's a long-running issue with the traditional media industry, there's still the opportunity to do that if you recognize journalists as actors in discourse whose job it is to find truths and tell the truths. So this truth determination function is literally given to journalists in democracies as part of the responsibility of the free press, along with the other two disciplines that are also doing truth-telling, scientists and historians. Historians are excavating truths from the past. Journalists are excavating truths from the present. If you don't know who the actors are, if you don't know how they did their stories, if you're not able to hold them to account, if you're not able to see all the work they did, the shoe leather work they did, how do we even know what's worth the reality that you're experiencing and where society should go? If it's all about knowledge that we as modern day professionals need to have to look good in our performative conversations, to do our jobs well, and that's all true. If it's about that, then yes, knowledge will help. But there's all the knowledge in the world, but we're still having democratic backsliding. All the knowledge in the world is not going to save us from a tyrant showing up elected through democratic means, because knowledge doesn't cut it in and of itself. It's democratic agency that seems to make the difference, and journalists are part of that agency. And I was worried that we're going to have journalistic labor and form, but if there's no way to surface that up in a substantial way, in a way that's beyond just revenue, if the user paradigm, if the paradigm by which people experience news and information is mostly in the form of these quick answers, which are informative. I don't deny that. I don't deny that the technology is being put to use. I'm still worried about the rest of the small d conversation. That's why I started the way I actually started. Because I feel in the technical issues and in the business issues, this aspect about what journalism really is for and what role it plays is kind of getting lost.
That makes a lot of sense to me. So thank you for that. But let's stay on that for a moment, because, wow, journalism in the United States as it is practiced now, when we look at network news versus cable news versus, you know, print or digital, you see a widespread array of stories about the same thing, you know, but they're written quite differently. They could, you know, they definitely, if we were to evaluate them closely, we would see bias. We would see subjectivity in that language. So is journalism in trouble already without AI? Because how is it for any person in the world to know who's telling the truth? Is it being given to me in a certain way? If I only go to the Wall Street Journal, am I getting all of the news? If I only go to CNN, am I getting, you know, that's already, I think, you know, a challenge.
That's the $64 million thing you asked. The question is, journalism already in a spot? And I think that's absolutely true. Without large language models, without this revolution in computational capacities coming forward from the previous generation of classical machine learning, which is task-based copying of human behavior and human decision-making, that's machine learning and all of that. Before all of that, journalism has always been in the kinds of spots where you can ask, are you really doing truth-telling? Because you are criminalizing Black people, you are excluding Indigenous American people, you are not even accounting for prioritization of sourcing based on the most vulnerable stakeholders who have the least amount of power versus the most elitist stakeholders who already have the most amount of power. So there's always been that issue, and that's because journalism has been a cultural occupation, remains a cultural occupation. So the way people come into journalism it includes people from the elites. So let me take a step back. If I've never been discriminated against in my entire life, if I've always been raised with some amount of economic safety and also, let's say, able to get my way through all the time in life, if I write a story about discrimination and source from people, that kind of story is necessarily going to be different in my language, in my choice of paraphrasing, than when a person who's actually been discriminated against or has been part of a group that's historically been such, and if they have to tell a story, the actual sources they choose, how they start the story, and the history of that city, all of those things will be not the same. And that's been the issue that traditional journalistic industry, especially the big legacy newsrooms, have never wanted to actually recognize. They wanted to look at journalism as a kind of technical craft with some objectivity, and the objectivity word got taken hostage from a method to a form that looks like style and neutrality and all of that, and sort of performative impartiality. So there's been all of these worries about journalism all the time. And I think the whole reforms movement about using journalism ethics and the discussions in ethics and media studies to kind of hold the industry to account. And now you're seeing a substantial number of digital native newsrooms, local newsrooms, newer organizations, BIPOC-led newsrooms, all of them challenging this old way of doing journalism as not the way. There are many journalisms now, and I think there's been a shift already. So when I speak about the journalistic form and labor that needs to stand on the web for its own right and intervene without being reduced to tokens, I'm talking about the newer forms of journalism that identify with actual democratic value and align with it, saying we don't have to play neutral with, just democracy. We are already aligned. We have to play neutral with claims that are in dispute when the controversy is actually legitimate. There, you need some initial, you need to understand everything before you start actually reporting a piece. So there are new forms and newer approaches, and I feel that they have to stand. If they're also reduced to tokens, I don't mind some reduction from all the fluff that's out there. There's so much in a news cycle, as you started out, there is fluff. There is reductive, derivative work that people are just doing for SEO. Some of that goes away because of the LLM summarization. I'm not going to complain.
Exactly. There is that. I know that I've done certain searches where they will pull sources from numerous media outlets, which then gives me a sense of what is being said or what are some of the more common opinions about a certain issue. Now, I've been noticing lately, and I've been traveling a bit, that the Google search results on page one are mostly ads, or it feels bot-like. So my concern is this, getting back to AI, is that, we're saying, okay, there's a concern about AI becoming the go-to source for information, which includes news. But gosh, is it much better on the other systems that we have in place now?
It's like this. If we come back and look at where human beings are as people on the ground, living their lives in their cities, towns, neighborhoods, and going through life journeys, some of them are raising young kids, some of them have their kids off to, university, some of them are retiring, some of them are just 18. If you look at that life journey, people use search as a way to find something quickly. They have a question, they already heard about something, there is a news cycle going on. Biden said, looked at Zelensky last night and said, President Putin, and they probably heard about it. So they went and typed something. So when people are searching, we've already acculturated ourselves on the internet for one click, quick answers. That's the whole I'm feeling lucky button that Google invented in 2001 or 2003, whenever they did that. So the idea of trying to use the internet and the technologies on the internet for quick answers predates LLMs anyway. And Google already had the answers interface, for example, built out so that when you search for something, even if you're not asking a question, in the keywords, you're able to see the other questions that get asked around that and the answers. And some of those answers go to licensed content. Some of those answers go to news articles and information and explainers. So people are already acculturated to the idea that when I'm entering from something I am curious about, or I want to know something quickly about, whether it's about the zoning law that changed in my area, and so I'm now worried that a couple of new buildings are going to actually emerge, you know, some tax law change, some school issue that emerged, some kid got kidnapped, whatever it is. People are entering from that level. They don't automatically go to a news publisher anymore because they don't have any predictability but that publisher that they follow otherwise may have covered that story or not. That whole level has been disintermediated by search already. Having said that, the search companies have become so big and so able to monetize that now Google started adding so many ads on the top that a lot of people are complaining. But if you look at Google's bottom line, it's not going down, it's going up. And that's because they're adding more and more of the sponsored ads to the top of the search page, which was not the case earlier. That's a business call they actually make. So I'm not taking away from the fact that people are at different points in the day. People are going to be at a journey through the day where they have the need to go to search. They will. However, that pattern is now going to answer engines. That whole thing should not really become a substitute for understanding the world through the work of journalists coming online, publishing stories on your local news outlet, on maybe a major regional outlet, or maybe the explainers or the YouTube videos you see. There's a certain experience you get about the actual democracy that you're in if you go directly to the 40 acres and a lie story, and you see the UX of it, and you see all the stories in it, and you go down to the bottom and you see the credits. The size of the 40 acres and a lie team that produced that thing should tell people how much effort it took. You're not going to see all that if you're going to see a citation with four claims from 40 acres and a lie saying, you know, this is what happened, America reneged on its thing, and blah, 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 and so on, and then you're gone. So I'm just worried about this continuous undercutting. I'm not taking away from the fact that you still need to go to search.
Absolutely. I mean, you made me think about a couple of things. I mean, there are a number of theories, you know, and I think advertisers have used this well in terms of the uses in gratification theory, for example, that the reason why people click so quickly is it's easy, right? So if you make it easy for the user, whatever interface you have on your, I mean, why do we use phones, right? So that's theoretically understood. We understand that behavior, and that's what, you know, search engines are doing. And I think that's important to know. And why it matters to journalism is because, as you mentioned, 40 Acres and a Lie and other amazing projects that we should all be reading and watching and listening to. When I'm talking to my teenage or 20-something college students, they won't get to that website. You know, they believe they're getting news. They feel informed, but they're getting that because it's coming into their feed. It's coming into their WhatsApp messaging, you know, a messaging system. It's coming to them as opposed to them going, okay, I'm going to go to the New York Times today, or I'm going to subscribe to. That's a real concern, right? Because yes, we journalists all over the world are doing such important things, but how do we get people from all viewpoints, backgrounds to know about it?
So this is actually a really important sort of transformational question about the internet itself. In 2005, I wrote a chapter for a book for Indian media students for a professor called 21st Century Journalism. And at that time, the internet was still what it was in 2004-5. And I literally wrote the words you just said. I said, people have to go to the internet now. You have to get onto the internet and then you go to the website of your choice. So you're choosing which websites you go to. And so if you follow a bunch of news sites, you'll go to those sites and see what they have to say. So that there was a model for the internet where people would have to go. But as more and more sites multiplied, as millions of sites emerge, and there's this opportunistic thing about how do I get the best out of a click, the distribution model that emerged was what made it come to you. So then you basically go to search and you just pull what comes off to you from your search query or now the answer engine. So now you have more at your disposal, but a distilled version or a summarized version. But there's still a difference between search and answer engines. Search without the AI overview feature, as Google actually calls it now. If you don't have the AI overview feature and you just have conventional search, which now feels quaint, if you compare that search without all the ads, and if you compare the answer engine outputs, there's a difference. The search people, they'd still preserve journalistic form because all they are saying is, here are the top 10 answers to what you asked for, the pages or results, and there are different types of pages there. There are pages that are news sites, there are pages that might be CDC government sites, there are pages that might be blogs, there are pages that might be forums. And there might be consumer sites on that as well. There might be advocacy sites. There might be associations of psychologists who have something to say about what you asked for. But people who see that can get a sense that there is a landscape of sources and publishers and sites. And then they have to pick one of those results. They might pick the first or the second, but they typically pick something on that page. And they still have to go to that page and see it. So while there's one more level of click and therefore that much more friction, at one point of time, that was considered the innovation and frictionless. Now we are saying this is friction, so we want to summarize this through LLMs. So this pursuit of reducing friction goes on and on and on, but there's a cost that we are paying in democracy as we continue to reduce friction because we can, because there's enough capital available to actual entities. So there's a transformation that's going online as well. This is not how the internet originally was, but this is how technologies that are building distribution and friction reduction are emerging to be. And that has implications for journalism and who does it and how they stand for it.
I agree with you on all of those. You know, the suggestion will be, hey, do you want to look at the AI results? And I'll look at them and I'll go, well, I don't know anything from that. I need to look at the more traditional search. And yet, obviously, in a perfect world, it would be better on both counts. So can you share how your role at Markkula has evolved to address the challenges, not just of AI, but just as we've talked about, there are a lot of challenges facing journalism.
So one area where my challenge really has evolved, to use the word you used just now, because I didn't know it will happen this way when I started at the Markkula Center at Santa Clara University, is this thing called journalistic sourcing, how it relates to journalistic behavior, and how machines are not able to tell the difference between 40 acres and a lie as a substantial amount of work of truth-telling versus 40 acres and a lie as an op-ed written by two people versus 40 acres and a lie as a cavalier claim made by somebody online. The approach used by machines, even in search and so on, to make these distinctions are around these industrial terms called content quality, reputation of the sites, authoritativeness, as in what computerized ways are used to actually calculate and rank the pages. So it's not like the technologies that distribute the pages that may carry all content around 40 acres and a lie, to keep to that example. It's not that these technologies can't tell fundamental distinctions, but the types of journalism online of different ethical qualities are not understood by machines. I can put my hat on that line now. Why? Because if you ask a machine to tell the difference between the sourcing used in a story with respect to the issue that story is about and the stakeholders that story is supposed to have, and another story, and where as a human educator in journalism, you would be able to say, this is a far better sourced story, and it stands for democratic value on where societies are today and where they could be going. And you've got this, which is a plain story. It has one elite source, one police officer, and that's all it has. But it's talking about other people without including them. It's not centering their claims. Machines are not even attempting to do that kind of thing because the people designing those machines are not looking at journalism ethics or the vocabulary in ethics to sort of build the necessary data, to build the necessary training models, to evaluate their accuracy. All of that comes back to academia because we have to make the case and prove that this is even actually feasible. I've had people from big tech, I can't name the people because these are off the record issues, but I've had people actually tell me from product in big tech that, Subbu, we cannot go upstream from news content into the journalism that was used to produce it. Why? Because that's political. Because the minute you start doing that, the minute you start looking at ethical issues as opposed to maybe clickbait, as opposed to maybe outrage, maybe language. So people are ready to do linguistic analysis, but not as much sourcing analysis. And I feel that's the area where my work has evolved. I've been standing for that. I produced some research on that. I'm doing more work. Literally, as we speak, you would not believe this. I'm not against Perplexity or any of these systems. I use LLMs in my own thing. We're doing an LLM research thing now to see how language models can pick up particular manifestations of sourcing that journalists put in their stories and trying to build what's called a sourcing manifest, like a flight manifest for a story. Why are we doing that? Because I feel that at scale, it's impossible to get humans to review all the stories that humans are going to see. You need to have a machine system. But how and when and how is it deployed? All of those things remain open to question. So that's kind of where my work has evolved. And that's why I'm at the interface between both journalism ethics as the ethics advocacy work goes, which is human-based, versus computational means and ends to serve that end of where journalism ethics needs to go.
Thank you. As someone who's led significant initiatives like the News Distribution Ethics Roundtable, what recommendations are you currently focusing on for ethics in news distribution?
Yeah, so centrally, I feel that platform companies, news aggregators, and even startups in the space need to embrace that there's a difference between journalism, journalistic work, and news. News is a product. News is a set of newsworthy claims. What UGC or users speak about newsworthy claims is also seen as news. But what journalists do through a process of work and ethics and so on is also news. So I feel there should be a distinction, first of all, when you're doing distribution, what are you distributing? And also, there has to be ways to ensure the long tail of the journalism ethics revolution that's actually happened that is producing authentic. So there's a term I use called that is actually authenticity. I think there is authenticity in many stories that include people who have never been historically included. There's a value for that, and that also has to be spotted in the distribution so that you take those types of stories and also rank them up. But you cannot always say the clicks on those stories are going to be lower, so the engagement is lower, so the business we make is less, and so on. So if you're always holding news distribution hostage only to money-making goals, then what is the responsibility to actual democratic worth when you're building big tech? That's partly where my advocacy goes, and that's kind of what we talk about in our roundtable as well, about just identifying ethical journalism better.
Right. So you mentioned money. Making money. And, you know, the reality is that most newsrooms in the United States are for-profit institutions. Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post. 15 billionaires own much of the media that we see, hear, and read. Six companies own 90%. My feeling, and this is just an opinion really, right, is unless you change the model, the business model of how news is gathered and distributed, then I don't see how you can change the argument.
So there's two things here. There's the business models of big tech firms that are going to help them do well, regardless of what happens to journalism or how journalism is funded, nonprofit, for-profit, long tail, legacy entities, newer entities, niche entities, and so on. Regardless of the different formations of entities that call themselves news publishers and the journalists they hire, regardless of how that model shakes out, which is completely disrupted now and it's in transition, the distributors are always going to win. So they know how to make cash money and they build their massive sizes on that. When it comes to journalism itself, I agree that this is a long-running issue on how funding is done. But I feel there's one conclusion there, that is because journalism serves the public good and there are enough economists who say the public good is never going to work on markets. Markets work for private goods. Markets work for things that have individual economic value as opposed to common community worth. As a result, there's always going to be a challenge on how to fund journalism or how to make enterprises actually pay for the cost of especially boots on the ground work. So the nonprofit renewal that you and I are seeing now, which is philanthropy led, is broadly an acknowledgement of the fact that commercial models are always going to fail the most important forms of journalism, actual boots on the groundwork that tell you what are the underlying realities that are happening right in front of us. But having said that, I think the big deceit, the big deception in the whole markets argument is that advertising technology platforms that were built and owned by Meta and Google or Alphabet, if you will, they have not really served the branding needs of advertisers to help journalistic entities that are producing a different genre of content and news and so on from made-for-advertising sites. They've kind of allowed the commoditization as a race to the bottom in terms of allowing economies of scale work. I think there's a lot to be done on how ad tech could be reformed to allow journalistic sourcing and intelligence about ethical journalistic work to be an assist to marketing organizations that want to brand better against that kind of work. And then that in turn will help revenue models have one more leg to stand on. Right now, we're all discounting advertising. We're all saying advertising will never pay for the cost. So we have to go to grants and so on and so forth for the newer long tail entities that are actually emerging. I feel the last word on advertising as a part of the revenue stream, online advertising to fund journalism, is not said yet. There's an antitrust case ongoing against Google at the DOJ and the courts on ad tech itself. I don't know where it'll go. I'm not the expert on that. But basically, I think philanthropy is holding the fort now. But I'm hopeful that there will be a way for CMOs and marketing leaders who are looking for better ways to run ad campaigns on ethical journalistic sites through ad tech. There has to be a way to make that actually happen. And they may be willing to pay more for those kinds of ads versus, you know, ads on crappy sites.
Right. What that brings me back to, though, is the algorithm, right? Because every time I'm speaking near my phone or my computer, every time I'm clicking on a page about, oh, I love the beach, I'm getting ads that I kind of like, right? I'm like, oh, wait a minute, I want to go to Italy.
It's a little creepy. I mean, the number of times I've had this conversation with my wife that we were just talking about it and the stupid headline shows up right now. How did this happen? At the same time, there is a relevance level there that makes you want to click, but it's truly internet technology that's come to the point where you feel the type of immediate relevance that you want to click. At the same time, you're feeling creepy about how it even came up. So it's that mixed bag.
Yes. I'm so scared of myself because I'm almost over the creepiness. You know, like I'm like, oh yeah, that is exactly what I want to do next. But here's the thing I wanted to connect it to with advertising because, okay, so you have this algorithm, it knows who you are, it knows what you like, and you're starting to get ads. And are you suggesting that newsrooms are unable to compete because advertisers would rather, you know, buy ads from Google and large search engines, which know what we want? Or is there a way for the newsrooms to get in that game? And I think you suggested that as well.
No, they're already in the game. The issue is there's been a problem with news content being seen as political. And because if you cover racism, for example, if you cover xenophobia, if you cover aggression against trans people and all of that, your stories are going to have that kind of language. Now, the ad tech interfaces allow advertising agencies that are representing brands to exclude or include sites with a set of keywords, for example, that say exclude all these sites that have these things because then we don't want our ads to appear next to racist sites. But there's a difference between a site that's racist and a site that covers racism. And if those distinctions are not made very quickly, advertisers who want to de-risk themselves are going to just move away from the news. It's just too controversial for them to put their ads in because all kinds of sites get it. Then they have to go look at for the amount of impressions they want, for the amount of actual inventory they want to buy, what's the simplest way to buy that inventory? So the platforms have the inventory. My problem is the classification of the advertising inventory on the platforms doesn't include journalism and journalism ethics as criteria, as quality criteria that brands can use. It only includes site level and hate speech and this and that. And if you want to exclude InfoWars today as an advertiser, if you don't want your ad to appear on InfoWars, you can. You just go put InfoWars.com on the list that says that's your blacklist and in principle, it'll not come. There are ad watchdogs that are actually watching that, like I mean, checkmyads.org, that's an entity started by two folks who are really interested in demonetizing, I mean, disinformation. So they try to get brands to make sure the ads don't appear next to Steve Bannon's sites or InfoWars and so on. But still, we have these approaches to try to get brands to not have their ads monetize, help monetize disinformation. But we don't have the means by which the opposite can happen, help monetize good journalism.
Is that something that you're working on now, or are there groups doing that kind of work?
I'm not working on that per se, but I'm starting with my ad tech critique to see if my journalistic sourcing automation type work, the ability to help machines understand the ethical quality of journalistic work across different grades, where zero is, I mean, disinformation, that's plain unethical stuff, that's not even news at all, and 100 is the most inclusive form of journalism, let's say on an issue like inflation, criminal justice, and so on. So I'm hopeful that that kind of work can lead to some other people partnering, saying, okay, we want to take this vocabulary, this data, and try to see if we can work with ad tech companies to, and also with marketers and actual advertisers to see if we can have an approach that will put a layer of targeting that has ethics built into it. Then I think we'll have a chance to have better monetization. That's why I said the last word on advertising as a means to fund journalism. I've not written it off. I just think there's more work that needs to be done, but it needs a lot of people. It needs a lot of people, and I'm not the only one.
It made me think about when I try to use, ChatGPT or Gemini or some other places that I've gone, you know, and I'm writing a story. I'm writing a novel and a memoir, and, you know, I'll go there, but I'm doing research and I'm writing things that they'll say it's too graphic. And you reminded me that in journalism, oftentimes we're writing stories about crime, we're writing stories about inequities, poverty, you know, you name it, things that don't seem to be okay being spoken on these interfaces. And that now is a red flag.
So that's partly the problem with algorithms that are being designed for intervention at the level of the surface that we call content, but not at the level of understanding the kind of agency that went into the production of that work and how that agency manifests in the content itself, in the site itself, in the metadata about that site. There's a lot more that can go into it. So yeah, so we should say if you have all the fancy LLM technology online to do all this, then if you're going to be interested in that, then we have to be asking how to make energy efficient LLMs that go wider into all of the richness of the context behind how content comes online and use that to make added distinctions. But the one thing I want to add quickly before we're out of time, Yumi, is that I've gotten one on the failure of advertising itself for journalism funding. I've got one critique from a friend of mine who's a professional at a major brand safety related organization. This was off the record, so I can't name the person. I've heard that news companies themselves, news organizations, are not banding together as a provider of advertising inventory in such a large way, in an associational way, to actually differentiate themselves on what standards have to be used to target ads on all the sites that they run, as different from all of the other sites that are non-journalistic. Because the news industry is historically not banded together, everybody tends to be exclusive stories on their own. There's a little bit of over-the-shoulder stuff. There's some citation issues. But as a trade association, there has not been that kind of work. And that is leveled as a criticism of the media industry, the journalistic media industry also being at fault in the ad tech system not having the kind of leverage or the push to change. Anyway, I just had to put that on the record, although it's an off-the-record comment.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. And before we close, I'd like to remind everyone to hit that subscribe button. Join me on AI and Journalism to hear more insightful discussions like this one. Until the next time, keep questioning, keep engaging with us, and have a great day. See you later. That's all for today's episode. And don't forget to sign up for my webinar where I'll be teaching you 3 ways to supercharge your LinkedIn profile using AI tools. And remember, this webinar is free. You can find the registration link in the show notes. And to stay up to date on all the latest offerings and my coaching sessions, be sure to register for my newsletter at yumiwilson.me and connect on LinkedIn and other social media channels. Until then, stay curious and stay informed.